Textron gives Cessna the green light to develop the large cabin Citation. NASA refutes claims astronauts flew drunk. And the Envision glass panel comes to early Cirrus planes. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Friday, January 25th, 2008. Almost 2 years after beginning market studies with a mock-up, Cessna Aircraft Company announced Thursday it will proceed with developing a large cabin intercontinental aircraft to add to the top of its line of Citation business jets. The Textron Board of Directors signed off on the project on Wednesday. Cessna CEO Jack Pelton acknowledged the long wait for would-be buyers. Quote, "We have invested a great deal of time in evaluating this concept to determine a solid business case and involved customers very early in this program. We're confident our efforts will result in an aircraft that is right for the marketplace." Unquote. Industry speculation already surrounds issues such as avionics and power plant suppliers, the aircraft's designation, and, of course, metal or composite. Cessna promises more details early next month. NASA found itself in the uncomfortable position this week of disputing a report the agency itself had commissioned. On Wednesday, the space agency again denied astronauts have flown into orbit while intoxicated. The Associated Press reports the denial is based on a new survey which reached 91% of the agency's astronauts and flight surgeons. Results were released online Wednesday. An earlier study, completed by an outside panel of doctors, engineers, and present and former astronauts, was released in July. It found two cases of inebriated astronauts flying into orbit on board the space shuttle. The report did not name names or specific flights on which the alleged incidents occurred, and survey participants were also allowed to remain anonymous. Ellen Ochoa, deputy director for the Johnson Space Center in Houston, did acknowledge one incident of perceived impairment of a crew member in a Wednesday news conference. Quote, "The incident involved prescription medicine and alcohol." Unquote. Dr. Richard Williams, NASA's chief health and medical officer, said the individual was judged clear and medically fit to fly. He did not elaborate, citing privacy concerns. Southern Star Avionics of Mobile, Alabama, tells ANN it has attained a supplemental type certificate to retrofit the Avadyne Envision primary flight display system into pre-2003 Cirrus SR-20 and SR-22 aircraft. The upgrade provides a modern glass cockpit similar to newer Integra-equipped Cirrus models. Envision is the first large-format integrated flight display available for retrofit in single-engine piston aircraft. Many other models and airframes are to follow on an approved model list, including the Cessna 400 piston twins. Envision was introduced at Lakeland in 2007 and marked another shift in Avadyne's business model, focusing on aftermarket retrofits and installation in experimental aircraft. Based on Avadyne's Integra system, parts of Envision were introduced with the Alliant Integrated Flight Deck developed by Avadyne and S-Tech for the King Air 200 and King Air 90. A market glut of expensive lawn ornaments has been averted. The Experimental Aircraft Association tells ANN the FAA has approved EAA's exemption request for the transition of ultralights and two-place machines to the experimental light sport aircraft category after the January 31st deadline. Now, this isn't a pass for owners who procrastinated. The extension covers only aircraft which were registered with N numbers before the deadline, but unable to complete airworthiness inspections due to factors beyond the control of their owners. These might include a lack of timely access to a designated airworthiness representative due to volume or weather, shortage of critical flight safety components from manufacturers, and so forth. Earl Lawrence, EAA's Vice President of Government and Industry Programs, was pleased. Quote, "Our good working relationship with FAA allowed us to understand exactly what these aircraft owners needed, what the FAA would allow within a request, and the time-essential nature of this exemption approval." Unquote. An example of that good working relationship is the annual midwinter EAA-FAA summit meeting at the EAA Aviation Center. That summit's now underway at Oshkosh with FAA senior staffers in attendance. More information on the ELSA exemption is available from EAA Aviation Services by calling 1-877-359-1232. Up next on ANN, there's new word on that British Airways 777 that landed short. Bush orders bureaucrats at the State Department to cut the red tape. And so far, the Osprey is confounding its critics. You're listening to Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways, and you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for January 25th, 2008. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Citing the urgency in getting information to other operators of the Boeing 777, the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board has agreed to help disseminate updated results of a British investigation into a British Airways 777 that was heavily damaged when it landed short of the runway at London Heathrow Airport on January 17th. Early on, analysis of flight recorders showed that on final approach, the autopilot commanded a thrust increase, and that a few seconds after the resulting throttle up, engine power dropped. Manual actuation of the throttle levers by the crew also was unsuccessful. Early hypotheses included a bird strike and fuel exhaustion. But British investigators now say there was enough fuel on board the plane, and they'll now be focusing on detailed analysis and examination of the complete fuel flow path from the aircraft tanks to the engine fuel nozzles. Further reports are promised as the investigation continues. The Joint Strike Fighter project held the promise of strengthening the relationships among the U.S. and its allies, but program suppliers have become increasingly frustrated by security-related red tape. On Tuesday, the White House moved to expedite the licenses and clearances allies need to collaborate effectively with the U.S. Contractors complain the security precautions have been overkill, impeding workflow, causing program delays, and complicating efforts to address world problems together with allies. Part of the purpose of the Joint Strike Fighter was to improve interoperability among allies undertaking efforts together, such as the coalition in Iraq. The Hill reports President Bush's Export Control Directive orders additional resources devoted to speeding up export licensing, procedural reforms, and upgrades to an electronic licensing system affecting export items controlled under the U.S. munitions list. That mandate follows attempts last year in Congress to streamline export control processes. The State Department has already been making progress. Following the heat last year from Congress, the administration says the application backlog has been cut in half since last April. After one of the rockier starts in military aircraft history, the Osprey tiltrotor is proving itself in one of the world's toughest maintenance environments. Marine Medium Tiltrotor Squadron 263 arrived at Al Asad, Iraq on October 4th to support air operations in the Al Anbar province. So far, the Corps says the squadron and its MV-22 Osprey tiltrotors have performed admirably. The Thunder Chickens took over the entire range of combat medium lift assault support missions in support of multinational forces west, from Marine Heavy Helicopter Squadron 363. The squadron has now completed more than 2,000 armed strike recon missions in the first 3 months of the deployment, logging 2,000 hours at an average mission capable availability rate of 68%. No big deal maybe in the world of commercial aircraft, but for a new military spec aircraft in a combat zone with lots of minds to change, it's just what was needed. The Federal Aviation Administration is reopening its investigation into a January 16th runway incursion at San Diego's Lindbergh Field, an incident the agency originally dismissed as posing no safety hazard, but which the Controllers Union described as very serious. A British-made Hawker Siddeley corporate jet had landed about 6 p.m. and was assumed to be taxiing off the runway, but it apparently suffered a mechanical problem and didn't clear the runway before a controller cleared Southwest Flight 1626 to take off for Las Vegas. FAA spokesman Ian Greger says controllers routinely clear planes for takeoff as other aircraft are still exiting the runway. He says the planes were never closer than 3,000 feet apart. Melvin Davis, a San Diego area chapter president with the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, begs to differ. Quote, "It was a mistake to do that. The runway was clearly occupied," unquote. While the FAA has apparently bowed to union pressure to take another look at the incursion, Greger says he's surprised by the union's tactic. Quote, "I'm surprised that leadership is accusing one of its own controllers of committing an error, while the FAA's safety office has yet to make any determination or ascribe any blame in this incident," unquote. Davis tells the Union Tribune that air controller fatigue, brought on by long hours, was a contributing factor. He said the controller involved was a seasoned employee in his 50s, but had been working 6 days a week. Still ahead, O'Hare's expansion plan makes progress, but faces more obstacles. Panama City's new airport battles protesters in federal court. And the Philippine aviation industry says, "Give us a break." You're listening to Aero News.
Welcome to Cirrus Design, maker of the world's best-selling personal aircraft, the sleek SR-22. Cirrus planes feature the latest technologies and are equipped with an exclusive, life-saving parachute system. It is our mission to make personal aviation safe, affordable, and convenient. At Cirrus, we offer a test drive like no one else in the business.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Friday, January 25th, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. The city of Chicago has signed a 20-year agreement under which the FAA will pay the city $42.3 million to occupy the North Air Traffic Control Tower that's now under construction as part of the O'Hare Modernization Program. The agreement will allow Chicago to recover money spent in the construction, and Mayor Daley's office says it comes in time to ensure the tower can be up and running in time for the November christening of O'Hare's new runway 9 left 27 right. While the agreement is a ray of sunshine in a 30-year storm of controversy over expansion at O'Hare, the fight is not over. A second phase of the expansion plan would require relocation not only of dozens of residents and businesses, but also of every grave in a 150-year-old church cemetery. The plan is expected to draw protests and has already been hit with one lawsuit. The St. John's United Church of Christ claims the federal government is violating its own Federal Religious Freedom Act, because the commitment of federal funds would bind the city of Chicago to complete the expansion. The new Panama City Bay County International Airport in Florida faced what proponents hope will be the final legal hurdle to start construction on Wednesday. Airport proponents went before a three-judge federal panel in New York City to confront three organizations trying to stop construction of the new 1,300-acre, $330 million facility. Wednesday's arguments pitted the Airport Authority and U.S. Justice Department against the Natural Resources Defense Council, Defenders of Wildlife, and a pilots group called Friends of PFN. The Panama City News Herald reports the three groups sued to overturn the FAA's record of decision, claiming the decision was arbitrary, violated established procedures, and would lead to destruction of environmentally sensitive wetlands in the West Bay area. Airport Authority attorney Michael Duncan told the paper after the hearing, quote, "We are still confident that the FAA was not arbitrary or capricious in its actions," unquote. Duncan says this was the final hearing on the merits of the suit, but there was no word from the three appellate judges on when a decision might be expected. The downgrading by the FAA of the Philippine aviation industry to Category 2 status has drawn calls from the country's government to revisit the rating in 90 days. Transportation Secretary Leandro Mendoza, appearing on a government TV show called The Cabinet Speaks, added his voice to a chorus urging passage of legislation creating a Philippine Civil Aviation Authority. He was chosen just last week by President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo as acting chief of the Air Transport Office. Mendoza told the Philippine Daily Inquirer that 7 of the 10 items in the airworthiness category have already been achieved. What remains is training of pilots to international standards, the computerization and integration of records, including information on pilots' credentials, and the hiring of qualified inspectors to license pilots and check the airworthiness of carriers. Mendoza says the FAA has offered to send consultants to help craft the law creating the Philippine CAA and to provide technical advice in the future. Mendoza said that while safety was an issue, security was not. He said that the ATO is on a par with international standards. And finally, an Air Canada Boeing 767, involved in one of the most famous dead stick landings in aviation history, ended its flying days in ironic style yesterday. Maintenance crews checking CGAUN on July 23, 1983, found the plane's fuel level sensors inoperative. Instead of grounding the plane for repairs, they let it take off after performing manual fuel calculations. At the time, Canada was in the midst of switching from measuring fuel in imperial gallons to measuring fuel in metric liters. Can you guess where this one's headed? The flight was crossing over Red Lake, Ontario, when the warning sounded in the cockpit, the engines quit, electrical power and hydraulics failed, and the crew figured out right away the fuel load had been miscalculated. Fortunately for the passengers, Captain Robert Pearson was an expert glider pilot who was able to figure out best glide speed using the still-functioning steam gauges and fly the plane using the now unboosted control surfaces. First Officer Maurice Quintal remembered there was an abandoned airbase below them in Gimli, Manitoba. And so the crew brought the Big Bird in for a dead-stick landing. On final approach, they discovered the airfield was covered with spectators watching go-kart races. Well, the landing was hard, the nose gear broke off, and the plane skidded to a stop 100 feet from the nearest spectators, who no doubt had a special laundry moment of their own. In the end, there were no injuries among the crew, spectators, or the 61 passengers. Both Pearson and Quintal survived the chewing out from their bosses at Air Canada and remained with the airline. In 1985, the pair received the first ever International Aeronautic Federation diploma for outstanding airmanship. The 767, CGAUN, returned to the skies, from that point on carrying the affectionate nickname the Gimli Glider after that abandoned airbase. But we all reach the end of the line someday. And so, yesterday, many who knew her story gathered to watch the Gimli Glider's ironic last takeoff on a ferry flight to a boneyard in Tucson, Arizona. Ironic because, 25 years ago, she survived fuel exhaustion and a dead stick landing and survived to fly again. Yesterday, she made a routine landing with adequate fuel, but will be scrapped. And that's the latest from Aero News. And hey, if you're looking for the perfect aircraft for your next dead stick landing, don't miss today's ANN special feature. I'll talk to Grone Brothers Aviation's Sparrowhawk project manager, Devon Hansen, about the company's just-released quick-build Sparrowhawk 3 two-place kit gyroplane. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to our AeroCasts. You'll find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at our website, www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plagg. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend and have a clear and unlimited day.